Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Office of the State Archaeologist was founded 60 years ago to investigate and protect the places and objects that tell the story of Iowa history. It's based at the University of Iowa, and these days it employs 23 full-time archaeologists and historic preservation specialists, along with dozens of seasonal staff, students, and volunteers. Last Friday, the OSA hosted an open house to celebrate this big anniversary. Iowa Public Radio producer Matt Alvarez dropped in for a tour, and he didn't have to travel very far because the Office of the State Archaeologist shares a building with Iowa Public Radio's Iowa City studios. State Archaeologist John Dorshuk showed Matt around.
So let me introduce John Palmquist and his wife Charlotte. John and Charlotte have been fantastic supporters of OSA activities for a long time, we'll
45
say.
45 years.
45 years.
Yeah.
Most recently, John worked with us on a grant to donate his collection of artifacts and associated information about the context of those artifacts so it could be in the State Archaeological Repository. So, John.
Okay. It's been an interesting journey the last 45 years. I first got in contact with the IAS up at the city of Cherokee, Iowa, when Dr. Dwayne Anderson was employed there at Sanford Museum. And we met him in August of 74, and I became a member of the IAS then. And for the next 10 years then, shortly thereafter, Dwayne was state archaeologist here, and he took me under his wing and mentored me for 10 years there. And it's been an interesting journey. Working with the office up here and collecting and learning, constantly learning. You know, the more we learn, the more questions pop up, it seems like. But it's been a great journey. And it's fun to be with on your 60th anniversary.
So John donated artifacts. Did he collect them himself?
Yeah, he collected he discovered and recorded over 100 archaeological sites in Southwest Iowa, and donated over 1,000 artifacts from those locations so they could be in the State Archaeological Repository and available for researchers to use for comparative analyses that they do.
Sounds like he's doing the good work.
Oh yeah, it's he's exactly the kind of non-professional who can make a real impact on the science of archaeology, because he contacted us, learned our methods, recorded what was needed to make it valuable to science, as opposed to just interesting rocks on someone's mantle or in a shoebox someplace.
I think I'd be guilty of that.
So we're inside the OSA building now, and walking from the front to more public area down the main hallway that is leads to all the archaeological offices for the staff. And we have 23 full-time staff at present. 10 years ago, we had a few more. We were up to 30. But the office all started in 1959 from just one single person who had a 9-month faculty appointment here on campus, and slowly grew through the 60s and 70s in particular, and really took off in the 80s and 90s because of the advent of what's called cultural resource management archaeology and compliance work being done to meet the requirements of the National Historic Preservation Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and other laws that were coming into place in our society. One of the functions of the OSA is to be the State Archaeological Repository, which means it's the place where the artifacts go from these compliance kinds of projects when they're done all over the state, both by our staff and by other consultants. And so we have, my lab manager tells me, material from 14,000 archaeological sites across the state. Approximately 4 million objects is our best estimate. But everything is very carefully packaged for permanent curation. That is, we are trying to make this stuff available down the line, not just for 10 years, but for a century or more. We have materials in the archives from the late 1800s, so we're already into our second century of material that's being curated here. Most of the material has been collected in the last 30 years because of the explosion of archaeology that is associated with those compliance kinds of activities. But it all represents accretional knowledge, information built on information built on information. And researchers come and use these collections. And why don't we just step in here so you can get a visual? It's hard to explain for your listeners.
Yeah, it looks, you have a bunch of gray boxes lined in here.
Right, that's all, paper records.
Okay, good. I was about to say, it doesn't look like 4 million.
Floor to ceiling, and in this case, the ceiling's 12 feet up. Of box after box, all carefully organized and labeled so we can actually find documents. Much of this material you can see is flagged to be ready to scan. We're also digitizing as much as possible so that the paper copies become the preservation copy that nobody touches, but we have it still with the digital ones readily available then to share more broadly so someone doesn't have to come to the office to see the material, and there's no wear and tear on it. And then as you go down this hallway, each of these carriages, this is called compact mobile shelving, and we have 23 carriages here, double-sided. Again, these are 10 feet tall, so we have literally thousands of years of prehistory and history cataloged in here and ready for use.
And this is all right next to the studio.
Right, yeah, we're just, you go through that wall and we're in one of your studios. So
4 million artifacts, wow.
I mean, that would include every tiny scrap of bone or stone, a bead or whatever, and then more fantastic things like an entire pot. So now we're moving into the main laboratory area. I don't know how noisy this is going to get for you, but we can give this a try. So what we did tonight for the open house was we laid out materials from excavations that the OSA was involved with since the 1960s and every decade thereafter. So we have picked material from every decade to feature and tried to pull out interesting artifacts. We put out the actual artifacts, labeled where they're from, what they are, and then also put photographs up for people to understand the context of the excavations as it happened so that they can take a trip around the state essentially and through time, both from a historical perspective of our work, but also then of prehistory as well and history across the state. I want to introduce you to Serafina Carey, who's been working at the OSA now for a couple of years. She started as a student and has graduated from the University of Iowa. She's now a graduate student at St. Cloud University, but working here about half-time as one of our curation specialists. So, Serafina, can you tell us, when you were putting together all the artifacts that we have out tonight, do you have a favorite in here that you want to tell us a little bit about?
Well, I would have to say one of my favorites is a clamshell fish lure that is from Mills County. The site is called 13ML176, which is part of the Glenwood locale, so about AD 900 to 1300. It's this beautiful carved shell. It has a motif of a fish on it. One of our volunteers who knows quite a bit about fish thinks it's modeled after a sucker type fish. And so the Wall Ridge site was the first one I worked on, and that was one of the first artifacts I ever handled. And if you can see it right now, you can still see the sheen of it from the original clamshell, and it's just a beautiful piece of workmanship that should be appreciated by everyone.
It was a necklace at one point, right?
Well, you know, that's what we originally thought, and as Serafina mentioned, one of our volunteers, who's an avid fisherman, got interested in it and started thinking about it. And it's really with the hole put there, it's more likely a necklace or a lure that would have been used to drop down through ice. So cut a hole in the ice and just drop it down and have it hang, as opposed to pulling it through the water. Because if you're going to pull it through the water, you'd put a hole up near the mouth of the fish so it could come through the water. But his research suggests it was used probably through the ice as a lure, and then the fish themselves were actually speared as opposed to caught with a hook.
So it was kind of like bait.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that sheen from the clamshell would do a nice flash in the water.
Well, let's talk about this. I saw someone putting this together the other day.
Yeah, right. So this is one of our favorite specimens that was recovered a couple of years ago at a site over in Scott County. The Danish Brotherhood House was being removed for an expansion development kind of project, and they were using federal funds, so they were required to do a mitigation prior to the new building going up, and our staff were hired to do the archaeological work, and in the process of doing that, they ran across an intentional dog burial. And this is a historic period, so it's not terribly old, probably on the order of 150 to 180 years old, but nearly complete dog skeleton, as you can see, including parts of its collar were still intact and when it was found. So it was clearly an animal that was important in someone's life, and when time came, they did a very careful burial of him. So he's nicknamed Sparky, and he'll be on permanent display here for research purposes.
A tour of the Office of the State Archaeologist in Iowa City at the University of Iowa, celebrating 60 years this year. With me right now is John Dorshuk, Director and State Archaeologist at the Office of the State Archaeologist. Again, a near neighbor to the Iowa City studios for Iowa Public Radio. Hello, John.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here and for giving us a tour of your studios. I do want to go back in time to 1959. Tell me what we know about the original intention for the Office of the State Archaeologist.
Sure. And thanks for having us on today and for being good neighbors. The legislative act that created the office actually has its roots a couple years before 1959, because as with many things of this type, it takes a little while to get the support and education out there for what the need is. And that was pretty much coming from members of the Iowa Archaeological Society, the avocational group that you heard a little bit about in the clip. And the membership in that wanted a person to be their mentor and guide. They wanted a state archaeologist. So they approached the then university president, Virgil Hancher, and the then governor, and got them talking. And Hancher had the foresight and also the knowledge of impending federal legislation at the time, the Federal Highways Act, one of the first big pieces of infrastructure building. And he knew that in that there was a clause that if a state had a state archaeologist and a state geologist and some of the other kinds of positions that were created, they would be eligible for federal funding that otherwise they would not. So he had the foresight to say, we need one of these and we want them to be appointed at the University of Iowa. And so between the governor and then the director of what was then called the Highway Commission and the Department of Natural Resources, got together and eventually got the legislative support to create the office on April 7th of 1959.
All right, and we'll talk more about that history in just a moment. This hour, we're celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Office of the State Archaeologist. It's based at the University of Iowa. With me, John Dorshuk, Director and State Archaeologist, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Office of the State Archaeologist was founded 60 years ago to investigate and protect the places and objects that tell the story of Iowa history. It is based at the University of Iowa, and just last Friday, they had an open house to celebrate the 60th anniversary. We'll hear a little bit more as the hour goes on about some of the things that visitors got to see at that open house. With me now is John Dorshuk. He is Director and State Archaeologist at the Office of the State Archaeologist. And Cindy Peterson is also with us now, Office of the State Archaeologist Research Director. Welcome, Cindy.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And John, just before the break, we were talking about why and when the Office of the State Archaeologist was founded. And so part of the founding was an opportunity, a real opportunity to take advantage of federal funding. But let's also talk about what happened to artifacts in the state of Iowa before the Office of the State Archaeologist was founded. I mean, there really wasn't a way to protect them, right?
It was very non-systematic. So in 1959, there were only, I think, maybe three professional archaeologists in the state. One was here at the University of Iowa, Ray Ruppe, and he became the first state archaeologist. Literally, once the legislation was passed, the president called up and said, congratulations, you have a new hat. They gave him no additional funding. They didn't extend his contract from his standard faculty 9 months to a 12-month. That happened with the next guy. No students were assigned. Not surprisingly, he left after that year. Actually, he had a great opportunity to found a Department of Anthropology in Arizona, so he took advantage of that. But prior to 1959, there was a Park Service archaeologist up at Effigy Mounds National Monument.
And I don't know that there was yet an archaeologist at Iowa State. I don't think the first one there came until a couple years later. So there was not a lot of professional activity or oversight. So when archaeological discoveries were made, when people ran across through construction projects or building projects on homes and farms, it was very haphazard who got to look at it. So local historians or just interested persons or medical doctors, sometimes as men of science, and they were mostly men at that time, were called in. But oftentimes the artifacts were just dispersed amongst the people who made the discovery.
Right. This is cool. I'm going to keep it.
And then those things get lost, and other family members don't know what to do with them, aren't interested. They get increasingly disconnected from their place and their context and become less and less meaningful. So the creation of the office for the first time gave really a focal point for what happens to these materials once they're discovered.
Well, and let's talk about how the Office of the State Archaeologist works and the relationship to state government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're in an interesting situation here, being at the university but having code-mandated activities, and that's unusual. I think the State Hygienic Lab would maybe fit into that model as well, but not much else. Most research centers at the university are independent of any connection to state government, other than perhaps the research that they do that helps those offices. But we actually have several things in the code that we're supposed to do, which is, number one, I'm supposed to be a member of the anthropology faculty and interact with them, which I do on a regular basis. We have a great relationship with the department, which is celebrating its 50th year this year, actually. So we're doing a lot of history with them. But we're also the State Archaeological Repository. So we are that physical place where materials can come and be curated using appropriate methods and then made available for education, research, and loans to facilities all over the state for their exhibits and displays for the public. We also maintain the Iowa Site File, which is the record of all known archaeological locations, and we're up to over 30,000 of those now in our records. And that's a very critical piece for the type of research that Cindy and her team does for the office, but also a lot of private consultants do across the state in support of the compliance activities that really are the driver for much of the archaeology that happens in the United States these days. We also are required to pay attention to ancient human remains, and that was a duty that was added after 1960. It came in 1975, 76 with the passage of the laws that protect ancient human remains in Iowa.
And Iowa was the first state to pass a law to protect ancient remains.
That's correct. We're very proud of our history. Iowa, in many areas of civil rights and justice, have been leaders, and this is a good example of that, the law that was passed actually in the mid-70s protects all human remains, not just ancient, but the ancient are specifically called out and then assigned to my office for its jurisdiction.
All right, and let's talk about the definition of ancient.
Ah, yeah. Ancient is an interesting one. In 1976, the definition was put into the code that ancient meant greater than 150 years in age. So at that point in time, we're talking 1826, 1827, there were virtually no non-Native American human burials in Iowa at that time. Europeans just hadn't spent that much time. There might have been an occasional French trapper or someone like that, but there really wasn't much potential for ancient to mean other than Native American. But it was a rolling date, the way the legislation was written. So now here we are in 2019, so 150 years before now is 1869, which means Civil War. We're talking about hundreds of towns all over Iowa having been established. There's existing cemeteries with tombstones marked where someone had died and is considered ancient. So I like to say those are my people, and we try to keep track of them as well.
You get new people every
yes,
year.
Yes, so, that's right.
So what does that mean when remains become ancient? What does that mean for archaeologists?
That means, according to law, that if they were to be subject to some kind of disturbance, whether it be a natural process like erosion, and we have had a couple of cases where these long existing cemeteries have started to slide downhill or something like that.
Right, a lot of them are up at the top of hills.
Exactly,
so, right.
Exactly. Beautiful spots, but treacherous from a long-term landscape management standpoint. Or if there's an accidental discovery or other kind of disturbance because of a construction project, then they have to come to my office and consult with us and go through a permitting process to be able to move or relocate those.
All right. And since more and more remains become part of this ancient group. Is that a concern? Because pretty soon, I mean, that's a lot of remains.
Right, yeah. If we get into the 1880s or 1890s, we could be talking about literally hundreds of thousands of potentially that we're responsible for. So that could become unmanageable. So we may need to revisit that definition at some point. And if you look around the country, other states, as they've implemented similar laws, have picked and chosen different sorts of criteria. Some have only made Native American burials eligible for this kind of protection, but that doesn't really work when you get into losing early pioneer graves, for example, that are rightfully deserving as well. Others have chose it as an arbitrary date, you know, 1920 or something like that, but then you get into interesting kinds of complications. So it's a challenging thing to come up with a good functional definition that will survive into the future, another 20, 50, right, 100 years.
And before we move on, I want to just talk a little bit about Native ancient remains, because there was no protection for those remains before this time in Iowa or anywhere, and terrible things were done to these remains. Tell me more about what this legislation actually meant.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It was terrible, and it persisted in many places around the country, even into the 20th century. So it took a while for things to catch up. Happily, the law that was passed in Iowa became an incubator for both other states, but then actually federal action. And the federal law went into effect in 1990, and that was the first time, as the phrase sort of goes, that Indians had a seat at the table, and they got to be part of the consultation process about what happens to their remains. Prior to that law and prior to state laws being passed, archaeologists tended to regard themselves as stewards of the past and as being in charge of the past. And as my colleague Bill Green said on Friday night in his remarks at our event, that has changed over the last 30 years. There's more and more recognition that there's multiple ways to understand the past and to interpret the past and for the past to have meaning to different descendant communities in particular, including specifically Native Americans or specific tribes within that greater polity, because all Native Americans don't share the same belief systems by any means, but then to other descendant communities as well in our society. So if we don't look at this plurality of understanding, then we lose the power of what diversity brings to us, and we want to preserve that if we can.
We were hoping to talk with one of the Native American advisors that works with the Office of the State Archaeologist. Unfortunately, she's under the weather. But tell me a little bit about that kind of coordination and the relationship you have with Native people who live in Iowa now or used to live in Iowa.
Yeah, the early 70s was actually quite contentious in Iowa. There were a number of events between about 1972 and the passage of the law that actually led to confrontations between Native American activists and museum staff, or in some cases archaeologists themselves, when human remains were found, ancient human remains were found, and they were determined to be Native American. And without the legal framework, nobody knew what to do. The Indians wanted to make claims on them, but they had no legal basis for actually doing so. They had the moral position, but not the legal position. The archaeologists were trying to defend their science and defend their status quo position, that they knew best how to take care of these things, how to study them, how to curate them. But that tension wasn't resolved until there was a case where one of the leading activists, Maria Pearson, in the state, had opportunity to work with Duane Anderson, who became state archaeologist in 1975, on a burial discovery in western Iowa. And Duane suggested that they use archaeological methods to remove these remains and then turn them over to Indians. And Maria was against that. She didn't want the archaeologists to have that primacy. So she said, no, I think a burial facility should come, mortuary facility should come. And Duane didn't think that was a bad idea. So he said, okay. And Maria made the arrangements. But when the burial director showed up with a backhoe and was prepared to just chunk them out literally and dump them into a dump truck and haul them away, she was like, whoa, wait a minute. Maybe the archaeologists have something here. Let's do this respectfully, carefully. Let's learn something about the context, who these people were, and then rebury them. And that was really the genesis of the law and the working relationship that led to the creation of the Indian Advisory Council that the office still has. We have, I think, seven Native American members that present, and they advise us when discoveries are made of ancient human remains.
We are celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Office of the State Archaeologist. Today with me, John Dorshuk. He is the State Archaeologist. Cindy Peterson is also here, the Office of the State Archaeologist Research Director. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Cindy, John said something a few minutes ago where he said that most of the archaeological work being done in the state of Iowa today is in response to compliance activities. So that is probably surprising to a lot of people. First of all, tell us what that means.
Well, that means that a lot of agencies, federal agencies mostly, and state agencies have to follow a law called the National Historic Preservation Act. And it means that if you're going to construct something using federal money or federal permission, you need to make sure that you are not disturbing anything a significant building or a significant archaeological site. And so in order to understand if anything's going to be disturbed, you have to go out and have an archaeological or architectural history survey beforehand. And so that's what a lot of the people in our office do for their jobs, is those surveys.
All right. And that also brings some real opportunities with it. I mean, sites that would never be excavated have to be excavated because of these projects, right?
Absolutely. For instance, up in northwest Iowa, there's a really large site. It's about 70 acres, and it's ancestral. It's about, the Dixon site is about 500 years old, 600 years old.
The most recent portion of it, but some of it's as much as 800.
800 years old. And part of the site is eroding away from movement of the river. And because it's eroding close to a road, so then the Department of Transportation steps in and says, we don't want the road to fall into the river, and we also want to protect this significant site. And so we're going to come in and put riprap there to stop the erosion, and we have to do an archaeological survey first. And so the Office of the State Archaeologist, was able to do a rather large-scale excavation there just a couple years ago.
All right. And you are the OSA's liaison with the Iowa DOT. And of course, when we think about infrastructure projects in Iowa, the DOT is the main leader in that. So tell me a little bit about archaeologists' relationship with the DOT.
Exactly. Since this is the OSA's 60th anniversary year, this is also the 50th anniversary year of our having a contract with the Iowa Department of Transportation. And we're not the only company in the state or entity in the state that does work with them, but we're the one who has done the most work with them for the longest time. And I just tallied some numbers, and we have archaeologically surveyed about 138 square miles of land for the Iowa Department of Transportation, which is 0.2% of all of Iowa.
All right, that makes it sound small, but it's really big.
Yeah, 138 square miles of archaeological survey is quite a bit.
Right, and what does it take to do a survey?
Well, you need the DOT to inform us about, there's this project, usually a road construction project or a bridge replacement project is coming up. And so then we receive that information, and we assign an archaeologist to do the background research, see are there already known sites there that are going to be impacted. And then we have a crew go out and do a field survey, which means you walk over the whole area, you dig holes over the whole area to see if there's any important archaeological sites. Now, most of the time, if we do find archaeological sites, they are just not at all important. Only a very, very small portion of the sites we find are significant and can give us important information.
All right. What makes a site significant?
It can answer important questions about the past. For instance, how did people live? What were people eating? What were they trading? What events went on at this place?
All right. So if you find the remnants of a dump that was on a farm, that's probably not as significant because these are questions we already have the answers to.
Exactly. We would not do any more work on a site like that. That's correct.
Somebody buried that on purpose. And
exactly.
It should probably stay that way. John, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, we do document the location of those kinds of deposits, mm-hmm. And they get into the Iowa site file. So the 30,000 sites that I mentioned include many examples of what we call non-eligible sites. And one reason we do that is that sometimes this compliance process that we talked about doesn't provide either full enough funding to completely explore something, or because of design choices, things remain undisturbed. So they might be initially identified in a broad brush survey like Cindy was talking about, but then because the way the engineering goes, it gets set aside and it never gets any further impact. So those things remain unevaluated questions. So sometimes they don't look very interesting at first, but we keep them on record, and it might be that a subsequent project comes through at another time, maybe 10, 20, 30 years later. And again, it's this accretional knowledge that's so important that we have a record. Someone can go back, do a little bit more work, and say, oh, this is now going to be directly impacted. And we know it's there, so the discovery part's done, but then we can evaluate it. And the evaluation step is what determines that significance or not.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we are celebrating the 60th anniversary of the founding of the Office of the State Archaeologist. It is based at the University of Iowa and these days employs 23 full-time archaeologists and historic preservation specialists. With me this hour, John Dorshuk is director and state archaeologist, and Cindy Peterson is the Office of the State Archaeologist Research Director. You're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're celebrating the 60th anniversary of the founding of the Office of the State Archaeologist. It is based at the University of Iowa. And with me, Cindy Peterson, she's Research Director for the Office of the State Archaeologist. And John Dorshuk is the State Archaeologist. And John, it is based at the University of Iowa. Why is that?
I would make the case that the OSA, as we refer to the Office of the State Archaeologist, is a perfect model for a research center at the University of Iowa. We're not a teaching department, but we do have staff who are involved in teaching some courses in support of the Department of Anthropology. But it's really because we directly contribute to the four pillars, as they're called, of the UI strategic plan. That's research, student success, public engagement, and diversity, equity, and inclusion. On the research front, we did a little digging into our archives. In 60 years at the University of Iowa, we have conducted over 8,000 research projects, and those have generated $78 million for the university. And that's something that we're very proud of, and that helps support us and our activities here. It doesn't pay the entire freight. There are some state general education funds that support us, but it's a big payback for the university and for the state for us to be an economic engine at the university and part of the research mission here. On the student success side, as I said, we do have staff who teach regularly. I do. A couple other people contribute. We're on graduate committees. We host undergraduate researchers here through the Iowa Center for Research by Undergraduates program and through independent studies and internships. So we broaden the experience of students here as they progress through their educational program. We're very publicly engaged. We're one of the few research centers on campus that actually get out and get to over half the counties every year. I think last year we got to 63, and that's pretty typical with at least a presentation, if not some kind of actively community-engaged research project that some entity is interested in. It might be a educational display or some other kind of project. And then on the diversity, equity, inclusion front, our work with the Native American tribes helps to make us relevant to them, them relevant to us, but both entities relevant to greater society. So I'm really very proud of all the work that my staff do on all these different fronts.
Now, earlier when we were getting a tour of the Office of the State Archaeologist, we talked about how many artifacts are there, and we heard from a volunteer who had donated a great deal of artifacts that, he had collected. And a lot of people, maybe not as often as they used to, but a lot of people come across artifacts in, farm fields or along creek beds or whatever. If you come across an artifact, what should you do with it? And what are you supposed to do with it according to the law?
Right. Well, I'm glad you asked that. That's an excellent question. It is a passion for many, many, many people. Obviously, folks like to collect all kinds of things in our society, but artifacts from the past are, a fascination, and, rightfully so. It's all about identity. Where did we come from? Who are we? Why did we make these things? How did they help people survive? All those things are, maybe not forward in people's minds, but I think it's the driver for why that fascination exists. So people do find things. With the advent of no-till plowing, cut down on, how easy it is to find things in farm fields, but it's still possible to go out and find fields that are spring plowed. Creek bed walking is a hobby for a lot of people. They're not necessarily out looking for archaeological material, but because they're enjoying nature and getting outside and walking these creeks, they run across things that have eroded out of context. And then there's those who are a little bit more sophisticated, might use metal detectors on certain kinds of sites, or, know places because they have some archaeological background, either self-taught or, that they've learned otherwise. So they'll go and try to target and find archaeological sites. So those folks we love to hear from. Anybody that finds anything, we're happy to hear from them. I would say, though, that people do need to be mindful about trespass laws, about where are they on the landscape. And it's one thing to walk across someone's fields. It's another thing to take something from one of those fields. And you have to think of it the same way that if you go to a state park, for example, you're welcome to use the picnic table or the grill or the trash barrel, but you can't take them home. And it's the same with flowers and trees and archaeological artifacts. They're part of the state property. So you have to leave that stuff there. And it's very true on federal property. There's actually a federal law that prohibits collection on federal property. So people should be very mindful if they're up around Corville Reservoir or some of the other federal properties in Iowa that they're breaking federal law. So be mindful of where you are. Get permission when it's possible. There's nothing wrong with collecting artifacts from surface context, particularly in, a creek bed where it's eroded out. We don't know where it's from anyways. Those kinds of contexts, if people see something and they want to pull it out. But if they contact our office, then we can record those locations. And it's the context of the discovery that's actually more important than the artifacts themselves. Once you take the artifact out of context, it loses a lot of information. Might not look any different to the average person, but almost invariably when someone comes to the office with a piece, we go, wow, that's cool. Where did you find it? And it's not because we're trying to catch them out on something. It's because the context of discovery, right down to, was it next to something else, on top of something else, under something else, drives the understanding and interpretation of what it means.
All right. Well, Marilyn is on the line. 866-780-9100 is the number that you can call to join the conversation. And she's one of these people who found an artifact. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. My father, who is now deceased, has or found when he was farming some arrowheads and then a larger rock that shows evidence of having had some sort of thong or something around it that would have, it's a heavy rock, so it, I assume it was used for a hammer or something. And well, I know where he farmed, but he never mentioned it, and it was only after his death when we came across it, and my mother said, oh, yeah, he brought it out of the field one day. And I was just wondering where we would go to get more information about it.
Yeah, well, my office is more than happy to work with you on that. We do a lot of information exchange by email. If you're an emailer, then sure. You can email photographs is an easy way to do it. If you're going to be in Iowa City for some reason and want to stop by the office, that's perfectly fine, too. You could actually bring things, but I know that's a lot of travel for some people. So starting with some emailed photographs and a little text on what you know, if you happen to know where the location is and can pinpoint it for us by telling us the township section range or quarter section, that kind of information, or just a street address of the farm, that would get us to, so then we can look at our records and see if we already know that there's a site there. Could it maybe that what your father picked up was a recorded site otherwise? So, yeah, we'd be happy to work with you on that.
And your email address would be?
You could email me directly. It's johndorshuk@uiowa.edu. So that's uiowa.edu. And if that's too much to have written down, Google Iowa State Archaeologist, and you'll get to the University of Iowa page, and you can drill into the State Archaeologist, and there's email addresses there for you.
All right. Marilyn, thank you so much for your call, and I suspect you hear from a lot of people.
We do. A routine. I just got an email this morning, in fact, from someone that had artifacts they wanted identified.
All right. Well, before we run out of time, from either one of you, can you tell me a little bit about some of the projects that are going on today in Iowa? Cindy, there you go.
Sure. Well, we're all well aware of the intense flooding in western Iowa right now that has broken through some levees. And if there's a levee break and it's a federally authorized levee, sometimes there can be money that will help you investigate archaeological sites damaged by the levee breaks. But when they're just a farm levee, those usually aren't federally authorized. And we have a situation north of Sioux City where it's just a farm levee, so there's no federal money that might help. And the levee broke in three places, and where it broke through, it scoured away a site that we call Mill Creek site. And this is ancestral to the three affiliated tribes, which is Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara. And when it scoured the farmland away, we think it took away about 3 feet of soil in places at a known village site. And what it left was about 80 to 100 exposed features. And that is, you go out and you walk on the land side of the levee, and you just see these oval-shaped or circular-shaped concentrations of artifacts. And in this case, there's each feature is full of hundreds of artifacts just exposed at the ground surface, including something that I had never seen before. And it was three of the features. And by features, I mean like it was a pit feature where maybe food had been stored and now just garbage was put in there several hundred years ago. But in three of the features, just entire articulated vertebra of bison had been tossed in three of those features. So it's pretty dramatic to see an entire long vertebral column just sticking out of the features. And so that's something the OSA, the Office of the State Archaeologist, is working on. How can we perhaps salvage the data that remains at the site when there's no mechanism, no funding mechanism that will help us do that? And so in this case, if we're able to go out to this amazing Mill Creek culture site, it'll probably rely on volunteer assistance if we're able to get out there again.
Right. And if we are able to organize things, well, if the water recedes anytime soon, too, because it reflooded recently, unfortunately, once the water recedes, if there's a window of opportunity before ground freeze, we may well be trying to assemble a team to salvage, and we'll put out a call for volunteers through our website and through our social media.
So when you're looking for volunteers, are these people that have archaeological qualifications or just excited, interested people?
Ideally, if they had some background, that'd be fantastic. But for something like this, we'd probably would take just about anyone who was interested and could help us and who's local, because we're talking about a location that for us to get to is almost 6 hours away from Iowa City. So,
well, this must be incredibly challenging. You talked about federal funding for certain kinds of projects, but tell me about funding challenges, because a site like this is so exciting, and to see it not explored sounds just devastating.
It is. You can't get into this this business of historic preservation without having a fairly thick skin, because you're going to have a lot of losses. But there's always fantastic things that are discovered and do add to the knowledge base, so you have to focus on those. The funding situation, I had a couple of people come through our open house the other day and say, oh, you have such a wonderful building. You must have plenty of money to do lots of things. And unfortunately, we're people rich. That is, we have a funding for our staff. The building is in reasonably good shape, but we do much of the maintenance ourselves, including
it's really very small.
It's reasonably, it's a good size for us. But we washed the windows, we painted the walls when, you know, for our open house, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of sweat equity that the staff puts in. What we don't have is much money to launch expeditions across the state. We don't have the funding needed to pay to put people up in motels, even if it's just the Super 8 or just feed them at the subway or even pay for gas. So we just don't have much wherewithal to get our staff out to where some of these locations are. And Iowa's a big place, so the 30,000 known sites are probably a drop in the bucket. If we could do that kind of comprehensive survey that the DOT has funded for their projects across the entire state, we probably have 300,000 archaeological resources to manage. So it is a little overwhelming at times.
Absolutely. So do you fundraise? Do you look for people to invest in archaeology in Iowa? How do you do some of these? I mean, you get volunteers, but...
Right. Some of it's volunteer-based. We do have some success with grant programs. Cindy, in fact, put together a grant to work at a site down in Van Buren County. It's called the Iowaville site that, if we have any time, she can tell you about. But that was a grant-based project that then had a lot of volunteer help to basically serve as match money for that grant. So that was a necessary component of it. So we've had some success with those kinds of programs. We haven't had a huge success with our fundraising efforts. If we had a radio station that we could get on every day and ask for money, that might help. But we're a relatively small fish in the big university pond where there's lots of fundraising going on all over. But we do have a steady trickle and some very dedicated people that help on a small scale keep things rolling.
All right. Well, and we have about 2.5 minutes left. So, Cindy, you want to tell us about Iowaville?
Well, we do have volunteers who have come and helped on projects for over 20 years.
Right.
So volunteers are a huge part.
Yeah.
And the Iowaville site is near the American Gothic House near Eldon, kind of by Ottumwa. And that is where the Iowa tribe lived from 1765 to the 1820s. And they had a population of about 1,000 people living in this village. And we knew from metal detectorists that just amazing things, silver brooches and lots of beads were coming off of the site, but we didn't know if there was anything left. So we received a small grant to go out and see, was there anything preserved or has it all been looted away? And with the help of over 100 volunteers who donated over 2,000 hours of their time, and then a few Office of the State Archaeologist staff, we found that actually this amazing Iowa village site is extremely well preserved there on a farm field in southern Iowa.
Wow, that's really incredible. And you talk about excavating sites, looking at sites, surveying sites. Do new technologies make this easier?
In the case of Iowaville, absolutely. We arranged for the National Park Service from Lincoln to come over, and they did some, we call it geophysical survey. A lot of people think of it as x-raying the field to see what lies below, although that's not quite right. But what it does reveal is where these features are, things like storage pits or post molds where houses used to be. And at the Iowaville site, we found that there are thousands and thousands of these features that are left below the ground, and we could find that out without doing much digging.
And those are preserved below the area that the plow has disturbed. So it's not just that there's artifacts mixed into the surface deposits, but there's intact deposits beneath that.
And so when you make a discovery like that on private property, I mean, this field belongs to somebody. What's that relationship like?
In this particular case, the landowner owns thousands of acres, and he's a very savvy businessman. And so he requested a small fee for disturbing his crops is what we called it. So we paid him a very small fee. And then he allowed us to come in and do a few excavations. And that's how we got to go on that property.
All right. So but it's up to the landowner whether you get to explore a site.
Absolutely. No, we can't just go on to anyone's property and dig holes. No.
But we are in conversation with he and his family. We're hoping long term that that might be some acreage that he would be willing to let go and put into public ownership for preservation purposes.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for being here today. I've learned so much this hour. We need to spend more time talking about the archaeology of Iowa. John Dorshak, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Cindy Peterson, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
John Dorshak is director and state archaeologist at the Office of the State Archaeologist. Cindy Peterson is the OSA research director. The Office of the State Archaeologist is celebrating its 60th anniversary this year. It is based at the University of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Matt Alvarez, Dennis Reese, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us anytime. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. And please subscribe to our Talk of Iowa podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Charity Nebbie.